Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, December 2nd. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Admissions process moving outside the box. Criminal history questions gone from applications at all U of I campuses. From Urbana. Admissions applications to the University of Illinois this year are missing a box, the one that asks about a student's criminal history. The U of I system has taken those questions off the initial application for undergraduate enrollment, but will ask students about criminal background once they have been accepted. It's a response to the Ban the Box movement that calls for eliminating criminal history questions from job applications or college admissions. Advocates say they can discourage even people with minor offenses from applying. Last year, a student-led coalition called Yes, Apply Illinois urged U of I trustees to drop questions about criminal and disciplinary history from admissions applications altogether. U of I Vice President Barbara Wilson said the box blind policy moves questions about criminal background to the point after an admissions decision has been made, but before students enroll, balancing safety and access. The boxes are gone, but they are moved to a place where we can safely manage the issue but get rid of the chilling effect of having them at the front end. All three U of I campuses are adopting the policy. The issue has been discussed nationally for several years in higher education circles. Illinois and other states have adopted laws requiring employers to ask questions about criminal history only after a hiring decision has been made so that applicants are evaluated fairly. Illinois lawmakers have proposed bills to prohibit public or private universities in the state from considering criminal history and admissions decisions, except where required by law. A House measure introduced last January by Representative Mary Flowers of Chicago failed on a 40-60 vote in April, with Representative Carol Ammons from Urbana the only area representative voting yes. A frequently cited 2015 study at the University of New York, Boxed Out, found that more than 60% of students who had to check the criminal history box didn't complete their applications. The following year, Sunny adopted to remove any questions about criminal history from its admissions process, though it asks about it when students apply for campus housing or other specific programs. That was an incredibly important and influential report, said Julian Parrott, Assistant Vice President for Academic Affairs at the U of I system, who oversaw the U of I's change. The Common App, which allows students to apply to multiple universities through one application, also dropped criminal history questions this year, though individual schools can add it to their section of the application. At the U of I, officials met with students, police chiefs, lawyers, advocacy groups, admissions officers, and others on campus who would be affected by the change, and talked with other states and university systems about how they handled the issue. The police chiefs were like, "What?" But when we told them what we were thinking about, they were perfectly fine with that. As long as the university maintained its ability to assess students' backgrounds at some point. Urbana Campus Admissions Director Andrew Borst and Police Chief Craig Stone deferred questions to U of I system officials. Parrott said the U of I wanted to ensure those ultimately admitted didn't pose a security threat to campus. Asking the question has proven incredibly useful. The vast majority of U of I students who answered yes to criminal background questions in the past have been admitted anyway, with 1% or less ultimately denied. The Urbana campus receives several hundred applications a year with a criminal history. A student who answered yes on the application was asked for more information, which was reviewed by a committee that would make a recommendation to admissions officials. In some cases, the admission was conditional on drug or alcohol counseling or other restrictions, such as not being allowed to live in a residence hall. Under the new box blind policy, students who are admitted will get a notice asking them to provide information about any criminal background, along with their final high school transcripts and official test scores, which they report up front but have to verify before they enroll. If they've been convicted or charges are pending, they must provide a description of the incident, the outcome in documents such as court records or parole requirements. Applicants are also encouraged to provide a letter of explanation. The information will be reviewed by a committee with members from Student Affairs, Campus Police, Academic Affairs, and other units. That panel will decide whether to admit the student with or without conditions or rescind the offer. As before, the committee will weigh the student's age or other mitigating circumstances, the seriousness of the offense, how long ago it took place, and whether the student has taken responsibility or made retribution. Students also have the right to appeal a denial. In the past, many more students were denied admission for disciplinary issues at their high school or community college than for criminal history. The discipline question is still part of the initial U of I application. Parrott said a student with severe behavioral issues in high school, such as violence or intimidation, could present more concerns than someone busted for smoking pot. Parrott said a committee at each U of I campus will track the new policy to see how it works. The bill introduced in Springfield last year would have allowed colleges to ask questions about criminal history after a student is admitted, but they couldn't use it to rescind an offer of admission. That was the sticking point, said Aaron Woodruff, police chief at Illinois State University. It also did not distinguish between felonies and misdemeanors or types of crimes. Woodruff sees a better model in a 2017 law adopted in Louisiana, which bars schools from asking about most convictions until after students are admitted. It makes exceptions that allow schools to ask about sexual violence or stalking convictions a growing concern on college campuses. Woodruff thinks schools should retain the right to deny admission to an offender who would pose a significant risk to students. Ultimately, that's our biggest concern. The proposed Illinois law only applied to criminal history information, so students who had been dismissed from school for a Title IX violation would have had to disclose that on their applications. ISU still asks criminal history questions at the front end of the application process. As with the U of I, very few are denied, and in those cases, it's typically for sex offenses or something equally serious. The U of I's decision doesn't go far enough for William Varan, a 2019 graduate of the U of I Chicago and founder of Yes Apply Illinois. He calls the questions invasive and humiliating. Varan would like the U of I to remove them entirely so students don't have to worry about their applications ultimately being rejected during that waiting period. You still have the possibility of getting denied. The policy also works against the U of I's mission as a public land-grant university and its messages about diversity. You feel like you're not welcome, said Varan, who is now a teacher. The U of I is a huge engine of a student's individual growth and transformation into a tax-paying citizen who contributes to the economy. It should be available to students who have a minor offense in their past and have paid for their mistakes. They're applying to a university because they want to better their lives. Challenging Trump takes toll on party's golden child, an article by Tom Kasich. U.S. Representative John Shimkus is feeling liberated these days. After 22 years in Congress, he's chosen to retire, get out of Washington, D.C., and return to his hometown. But the Collinsville Republican still has a year left in his term, and it appears he's not going quietly. Last month, he wrote a column, which unfortunately did not get wide distribution, that was remarkably prophetic. More than a month before the House impeachment inquiry hearings involving President Donald Trump and Ukraine, along with unproven allegations that Ukraine meddled in the 2016 U.S. elections, Shimkus wrote a stirring defense of the Eastern European country. He also took on Trump and his allies who insist it was Ukraine and not Russia that interfered in the elections. Our own 2016 presidential election was, unfortunately, the first time many Americans learned that Russia interferes in the domestic affairs of sovereign states through social media and their state-owned media outlets like RT and Rupli, Shimkus wrote October 8th. The Ukrainians have been engulfed in this type of war with Russia as well. They aren't falling for Russian propaganda. and neither should we when faced with it in our own society and in our own elections. He concluded, "I also urge restraint to those who would drag Ukraine and President Zelensky into the scorched earth politics of personal destruction practiced here at home these days. Ukraine is caught in a very real war against Russia, and they need the encouragement and reassurance of the United States' friendship and support. Peace, democracy, freedom, and the rule of law is all that Ukraine is asking for. We should support that by respecting their duly elected leader and continuing to aid them in the fight against our common enemy." Shimkus, a West Point graduate who served in the army on the old Czechoslovakia-West Germany border from 1981 through 1984, says his affinity for Eastern Europe comes from his heritage, he's Lithuanian, and his appreciation for countries that broke away from the old Soviet Union, some of which have joined NATO. It's also why he wrote a column in August 2016 defending NATO against verbal attacks by his party's candidate for president. NATO has thrived for many decades throughout countless election cycles in many countries. These countries have all gone through swings from the left to the right and back again, he wrote at the time. But even as national leaders have come and gone, NATO has remained steadfast in its mission to provide security for all its members, and it must continue to be that guarantee for future generations. Shimkus admitted he was careful in both columns not to mention Trump by name. "I didn't want to call him out. I didn't want to poke the bear." And he credited Trump for getting European nations to increase their support for NATO. The president is right that some of these bigger European countries are not paying their fair share. Only this president, crazy as he is, could get them to pay more. But his message now is that the United States should stand by Ukraine and not tear it down. Cut Ukraine some slack because of the world they live in, the difficult neighbor they have who's been meddling in their affairs since 1991. They have a duly elected president and a parliament that wants to look west and reform. It's a big country, the largest in Europe, that could be an important U.S. ally. They've got like 35 to 45 million people. It's the largest landmass in Europe, a real breadbasket. It's not like our friends in the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. It's a big country by European standards, and it speaks to why the Russians are so against them going into the Western orbit. Shimkus said he didn't watch the impeachment hearings, primarily because his Energy and Commerce Committee was busy passing out 16 pieces of legislation in 2 days, thereby destroying the argument that Congress is too focused on impeachment to do anything else. Some will get floor votes this month, but the impeachment debate is wearing people down, both in Congress and in Collinsville. The supporters of the president are really angry over this. At church, I just happened to say to one man, "Well, the president really isn't a very nice guy." And he said, "Well, that's what we need, guys who aren't nice and will take on all those bureaucrats." I just said, "Okay," and moved on. Shimkus is surprisingly noncommittal when asked whether he is against impeachment. "Yeah, I think so. I think the best answer is to continue. We don't know what the articles of impeachment are. They haven't been filed. It's kind of a cop-out, but let's see what they bring to the House floor. My guess is, though, that I think we should just let it go through the election cycle." Shimkus's congressional district is overwhelmingly Republican, but also fiercely pro-Trump. He heard it from his constituents when he said in October that he was so heartbroken over Trump's abandonment of Syria that he could no longer support the president. It's essentially made Shimkus powerless in helping to choose his successor in Congress if he wanted to. "But what could I bring them? Because of my frustration with the president in some areas, I'm not the golden child anymore," he said of his relationship with the president. "I'm not bad. I haven't been tweeted against. I think I'm still in the family, but it's like someone they invite to the Thanksgiving meal and they hope they behave." And from Champaign's surprise visit, latest step in injured Illini's recovery. Bobby Rountree propelled his wheelchair through the door of the Illinois locker room at the Smith Football Performance Center before Illini coach Lovie Smith took over to push him the rest of the way. Roundtree's presence before Saturday's regular season finale against Northwestern was a surprise. The look on his teammates' faces and the roar when they saw him backed that up. "I was speechless," senior linebacker Dale Harding said. "Nobody had no idea. We thought we were bringing it up to say our prayer before the game. I looked around because it was kind of early to bring it up." Saturday was Roundtree's first time on the Illinois campus since he suffered a severe spinal cord injury after a swimming accident this past May in Florida. He spent the past several months at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab in Chicago with the goal to return to Illinois as a full-time student in January. The Illini have kept Roundtree a part of their bowl season. His locker is waiting for him. His teammates have FaceTimed him in for post-game celebrations. Seeing him in person, albeit unexpected, was emotional. "Unbelievable, you know," junior offensive tackle Alex Paluski said. "I FaceTimed him and I saw him at Big Ten Media Days, but to be able to see him actually here meant the world to me. It was unreal to be able to see him. We dedicated this season to him, so seeing him in person was definitely emotional." Roundtree delivered a brief pregame pep talk to his teammates. "Let's turn it up today, for real. Let's do it. Where's the juice at? You boys ain't turned up. Where's the juice?" That got his teammates going. It also wasn't anything different from the role Roundtree served before his injury. "They were the same words he'd say when he was healthy," said redshirt senior running back Dree Brown. "Even last year when we'd be on offense in the huddle, he'd be getting us hyped up. He probably just came off a 10-day play drive. That's just Bobby." Brown called Roundtree's return to campus bigger than football. "It's truly a miracle, just the condition he was in to look where he's at now and just talking and smiling. It's so inspirational. It kind of fits with his team, just a bunch of fighters." Smith has been by Roundtree's side since the injury. The Illini coach flew immediately to Florida and stayed with Roundtree in the hospital in May. He also helped establish an irrevocable trust to help Roundtree and his family with the costs associated with his long-term care. An initial goal was set to raise $97,000. A total of $119,000 has been raised since October 25th. "He's made so much progress getting his strength back up, working daily," Smith said after the Illini's 29-10 loss to Northwestern and the regular season finale. "If you saw what he does on a daily basis to get himself back on campus here at the U of I, you just have to be pumped up about it. He's been working to get back here with his teammates." Bobby and all of us are going to figure out how to take the next step. Of course, the goal for Bobby is to walk again. We see the progress that he's making. Part of the progress is to get back here on campus. An awful lot went into that. So many people up there have done such a great job with him. U of I system among 200 signatories. It declares climate emergency, commits all who sign to 3-point action plan from Urbana. More than 200 higher education institutions around the world, including the University of Illinois system, are declaring a climate emergency ahead of a major UN meeting on climate change this week in Madrid. The SDG Accord is an effort by colleges, universities, and higher education organizations to support global sustainable development goals and urge action to avert climate change. It calls on governments and other higher education institutions to declare a climate emergency and back this up with actions that will help create a better future for both people and our planet. The signatories include U of I System President Tim Killeen, committed to a 3-point plan that includes mobilizing more resources for action-oriented climate change research and skills, going carbon neutral by 2030 or 2050 at the latest, meaning any carbon emissions are offset by reductions elsewhere, and finally, expanding environmental and sustainability education across their campuses and through community outreach programs. The letter says a drastic society shift is needed to combat the growing threat of climate change. The young minds that are shaped by our institutions must be equipped with the knowledge, skills, and capability to respond to the ever-growing challenges of climate change. We all need to work together to nurture a habitable planet for future generations and to play our part in building a greener and cleaner future for all. The Climate Action Plan for the U of I's Urbana campus, which will be updated in 2020, already is committed to being carbon neutral by 2050 or sooner. Leaders of dozens of universities around the world have signed the Climate Emergency Declaration from Germany, the UK, Canada, Mexico, Japan, France, Saudi Arabia, India, Uganda, Venezuela, Costa Rica, and others. Today marks the start of the 25th Conference of the Parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is charged with making sure that the Convention and the 2015 Paris Agreement are being implemented. UN officials cite recent reports showing that levels of heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere have reached another record high, meaning that future generations will confront increasingly severe climate change effects, such as rising temperatures, extreme weather, and rising sea levels. The UN Environment Program warns that reductions in greenhouse gas emissions of 7.6% a year from 2020 to 2030 are needed to meet the internationally agreed goal of a 1.5 degree increase in average global temperatures over pre-industrial levels. Scientists agree that will be difficult and the window of opportunity is growing smaller. More than 70 nations have committed to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, though not countries that emit the most greenhouse gases, including the United States. This is the final conference before many nations must submit new climate action plans in 2020. This year's conference is important towards getting the countries on track for their current promises and to also further strengthen their reductions in emissions, said climate expert Donald Wobbles, U of I professor of atmospheric sciences. He has led studies assessing the potential impact of climate change on urban areas, agriculture, and water resources, and was a lead author on reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. The United States needs to be a part of this, but isn't. The world is increasing carbon emissions, not reducing them. While there are signs of positive change, such as the growing use of solar and other alternative energy sources for transportation and power needs, we are doing so very slowly. Campus spreading powerful message. At first glance, the issues playing out on the screen in the lower level of Krannert Art Museum throughout December might not seem to directly intersect. A 55-minute loop of 7 videos will play discussing homelessness, drug use, race, and class. Each one is different from the last, and each brings up a whole different set of rich issues, Krannert Art Museum curator Amy Powell said. The short documentary-style videos, though, all have at least one thing in common. They discuss those topics in the context of HIV and AIDS. The collection of short films is commissioned by Visual AIDS, an organization that utilizes art to highlight issues concerning HIV and AIDS. The topics of the videos, which will play in similar exhibits across the country, include a look at Keith Seiler, who helped find housing for homeless New Yorkers living with AIDS, the disproportionate effects of HIV on Black women living in the South, the stigma surrounding HIV and AIDS, and more. Recognizing that the fight against HIV and AIDS is an intersectional issue, it involves so many different ways of thinking, whether it's homelessness or drug use, race and class, and that was true of activists and artists in the 80s and 90s. So we still have a lot to learn from that time and from folks who are involved now. Today, which is World AIDS Day, the films will play on a loop both at Krannert Art Museum and in the lobby of Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. They'll continue to play on loop at the museum through December 23rd. It's just such a powerful program that we wanted to show it a little bit longer. We've worked in the past with the U of I Department of Gender and Women's Studies, and I've heard from their students and faculty how moving the program is, both from an artistic perspective and a kind of social justice activist perspective. To Powell, the program isn't simply about HIV and AIDS, or any of the specific topics discussed, although keeping alive the conversation about the disease is part of the mission. It's about the legacy of activism surrounding the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and 90s, and learning how to apply it to current times. It's important for a few reasons to keep that time alive. First, because the AIDS crisis is not over, and for whom it's not over is a big question. But also, those strategies of protest are useful again to us today. We are living in a time of crisis, and we have a lot to learn from our forebears in the arts who were activists and who organized when they were facing death and extermination. And from High School Confidential, Kids Doing Good Things from Centennial. Students in Shannon Perocco's AP Pathways drawing studio class prepared for the attached art show at Krannert Art Museum last Thursday. The students made art pieces based on inspiration pieces from their field trip with Central and Urbana High Schools earlier this year. And from Central, Jack Dubay leads a presentation for the business class's new athletic recruitment app, Fanpalooza. An informative session was held for student athletes, encouraging them to join. And from Monticello, chapter president Zoe Dye and teacher Elizabeth Ross, an annual fundraiser to help continue the FFA program. From Rantoul, National Honor Society conducted a Thanksgiving food drive, collecting food for over 15 different families with the help of every first class period. And from Academy, the U.S. History, the sophomore class is making a timeline highlighting important events. And from Fisher, student council advisor Bob Lindsay and student Zach Hoffman and Andrew Ferguson collected items to recycle. Students have recycled over 11,000 items this school year. And from Uni High, the school's annual Diwali lunch includes a free meal of traditional Indian food prepared by parents of students. Diwali is the Hindu festival of lights celebrated in the fall to spiritually signify the victory of light over darkness. Students are given a free meal of traditional Indian food prepared by parents of students from the Indian subcontinent. Costco's construction starting date, springtime. Construction of the new Costco store in Champaign is expected to start next spring. The city has issued a building permit for $23 million building plan for the site of the former Bergner's at Marketplace Mall. Coming down along with the old Bergner's will be the interior wall space west of Justice and Torrid. Costco has 783 warehouse stores in all. And earlier in November, Costco reported sales of $11 billion for the 4 weeks ended November 3rd, up 6% over the same time last year. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, December 2nd. Please stay tuned.